Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You have now entered the House of Mystery on KXIM 98.3 FM Iowa with your hosts Al Warren, Kev Thompson, and Julie Sav.
All right, everybody, and we are back in the House of Mystery, and today we're going to be talking true crime. You're listening to your host, Kevin Thompson, and I'm being joined by my co-host,
Julie Savo.
Hey, everybody. We've got a great show on deck for you guys today. We're being joined by Dr. Angela Hattery and Dr. Earl Smith, and today we're going to be talking true crime. We're going to be discussing a lot of areas that I don't really think, Julie, that we pay enough attention to. We're going to be talking to our experts in areas related to race, gender, violence, and my specialty as I work in the field, the criminal justice system, and perhaps the disparity in crime. So let's just go ahead and bring our guest on, Dr. Hattery and Dr. Smith. Welcome aboard. Welcome to the House of Mystery Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
So guys, let's jump right into it. Tell us a little bit about yourselves, you know, ladies first, and kind of what brought you here.
Oh, thank you. So my name is Angela Hattery, and I'm the director of the Women and Gender Studies Program at George Mason University, way out in Fairfax, Virginia. And for a number of years, along with Dr. Smith, we've been studying racial disparities and gender disparities in the criminal justice system. And, you know, out of all of that work, we decided that there was a little bit of a gap in the way that people were talking about race in the criminal justice system that we thought we could fill. So we put some research together and published a book, Policing Black Bodies, which came out in December.
So, I mean, let's go back. I mean, you just said a lot there. Let's go back to this. I mean, tell us the backstory on this, because it sounds like there's more to this.
More to the book, sure. So like many of your listeners and viewers, we were also watching all kinds of events take place over the last few years in which unarmed black men were being shot by the police, protests were happening in the street, the Black Lives Matter movement mm-hmm. was going on, all of that. And we realized that in all of the commentary, especially on cable news and Twitter and Facebook, people were ignoring what it was all really about, which was a history of racial tensions in a variety of communities. And so we thought, aha, that's the niche that we can add some analysis to help people have a better understanding of what's actually going on.
True, and I agree. Earl, what was your take on this before we jump into the topic deeply?
I've been studying issues of criminology for a long time, and I worked previously out in Pullman at Washington State University, mm-hmm. and I spent 4 or 5 years teaching and doing administrative work at Pacific Lutheran University. So I know a little bit about Washington State. I used to take my students down to Walla Walla, those sort of safe visits that I don't know if they still do that down there. But issues of crime has always been important to me in my teaching, in my research. And when we started talking about this book, Policing Black Bodies, we wanted to ask several questions, but we wanted to ask the question, what could we tell the prospective readers that's new? As Professor Hattery said, people probably watched the TV screen. If they read newspapers, they knew about Trayvon Martin, Philando Castile, Mike Brown. They probably knew about the disturbances or riots in Baltimore, but they probably didn't know much more than that. And so this book tells the much more than that story.
You know, I have to agree with you. Just being an average Joe doing a radio show, I have to admit that as a society, we get probably 90% of our news through visual media or, you know, your major networks. So whatever they cover is what we believe, and that's what we base our social view on.
I think I'd completely agree with you, Al, because, I mean, from my perspective, I mean, up until last year, guys, I lived in the UK, and even now I live in Cyprus. So the information that many people obtain, and I've been in social care for many years, working with people in a way to affect change, people believe what they see on the television. And they don't understand the intricacies and the complexities around culture and the disparity of treatment of different cultures. So I think introducing kind of some of that history and those accounts is absolutely imperative.
I'm glad you said that. I'm going to throw out a name before we get any further. And it's Stephen Clark. Mm-hmm. Or Stephen Clark.
Yeah.
And you folks might know about Stephen Clark or Stephen Clark.
That's most recent. That's actually a much more recent case. Why don't you tell us?
So recent that it was, I think, Sunday night. This 20-something young man was shot, black, unarmed young man was shot and killed by the Sacramento, California Police Department. And the reason why I threw out his name is because when this happened, we checked every major news outlet out there, the ones that you previously mentioned most people get their news from, and not one had covered this story. And so it becomes.
Would I be
like
right
another...
in thinking that? I haven't seen this on the news, but would I be right in thinking that Stefan's story replicates, and I wouldn't know the name of the gentleman, and that's the point I'm guessing here, is that this very similar, a similar incident happened some years ago. Very similar, that was very much broadcast, because I remember it being on the major television channels in the UK. But I wouldn't know, unless I'd researched it, which I'd obviously did before this interview, about Stefan. So has there been a shift, do you think, in terms of the reporting of these?
And you're probably talking about Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his name is a household name in the United States, but not necessarily in the UK or anywhere else. And I think that, you know, that's exactly the point all of you are making, is that the point of the book was, you know, a lot of the emphasis really came from watching race riots that took place in Baltimore after the murder of Freddie Gray. And as we watched all that accounting on cable news, it was quite obvious that it was about race, but that was the last thing that anybody was talking about. So people were talking about, you know, why are black people walking in the street? Why are high school kids coming out of school and, you know, protesting in the street? Why are those things happening? Even white analysts who said, you know, why did the protesters burn the CVS, which is the only store in the community?
Right.
And our question was, why aren't you asking why is there only one store in the community? You're asking the wrong question, and you're not focusing on the right thing. And, you know, Stephen Clark's murder will follow many of the same patterns. Instead of Skittles and iced tea, it was a cell phone. And that's really what we try to do in our analysis. So you're exactly right.
So let me ask this, though. Let me back us up just a little bit. In today's society, I mean, we're inundated with horrible events. I mean, we've got riots everywhere going on. We've got murder everywhere that's going on. Is it not possible that this one is simply one voice in a crowd?
No, I'm going to say no, and here's why. This is a systemic pattern of the killing of unarmed black men, mm-hmm. because you probably wouldn't have a program asking experts to come on the program to talk about the killing of unarmed white men. It would never happen. And it would never happen because that atrocity is rare. It's very, very, very rare. It's not systemic. And young white men do get killed by the police. But the pattern is not there. And the point we make in this book in terms of delving new information is that this is a systemic pattern. And I said, well, let me throw out one name. We have a database. Lots of people have databases. But we have a database that we use to write that particular chapter. And that's 60, 70 names on it.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that something is going on here in terms of the relationship of the police to the African-American community. That's clear to us. And that's why we put together this book. But we go well beyond that important topic. And so we have 8 or 9 chapters where we talk about the various ways that policing, in the broader sense of the term, is imposed on the African-American community. And we don't think there's any other book out there that addresses this topic in such a wide, as wide as we do.
What were the challenges in putting your book together? Because I'm just writing a book now. I'm a medium, and I'm just writing a book about my experiences and finding that I'm challenging in almost every paragraph and trying to tread carefully but also keep the book real as I write. What were the challenges that you guys had in putting the book together?
Well, congratulations on writing a book. It's a lot of work. And it's hard. I think that, you know, there were a lot of challenges. I think I'll just point out, you know, three. One challenge was, as we were writing the book, the summer of 2016, when we were drafting the book and really writing it out, in one week in the summer of 2016, the week of July 4th, there were, I believe, 3 black men, unarmed black men shot or killed by the police. And then there was a black shooter who shot a number of police officers in Dallas, Texas. And it was exploding while we were literally writing that chapter. And one of the challenges was, when do you stop? When do you say, okay, this phenomenon is going to continue, but I need to, you know, get the book into print. So one challenge is, when you're writing about something that's contemporary, you know, when do you stop and say, if there's more cases, you know, we'll deal with that in the next book. Mm-hmm. I think another challenge was, how do you talk about something that's potentially very provocative? How do you be honest about what's happening in a way that people who have never thought about it before or think differently or see different kinds of news, consume different kinds of media, are going to disagree with you. So the example that, you know, Dr. Smith gave about white men are shot by the police, and if your lens is then to constantly question our argument that black bodies are policed differently, how do you write that in a way that people who might be inclined to have never thought about it or see the world that way, how can they hear that? I think, you know, that's another big challenge.
Because automatically, if we hear something we don't know or understand, we tend to put our wall up, don't we? So you have to kind of get through that and help people to understand it without telling them what to think.
Yeah, exactly. And then I think the third challenge that most authors face is what do you leave in and what do you leave out? You know, where do you set the boundaries? And we're already, I think, you know, Earl can talk about it, we're already talking about if the book comes out in another edition, what's the next chapter going to be? Because we're already thinking about, you know, other ways that black bodies are policed. So I think at least those are three of the challenges that came up, and you may have more, Dr. Smith.
Well, a fourth challenge is for us as scientists, objectivity.
Right.
We're well aware that police are also killed by citizens.
Mm.
But we make it clear up front, very up front in the book, that we're talking about essentially state-sponsored violence. We're not talking about the randomness of what happened in Dallas, for example. We're talking about something that seems to be very, very calculated. And one of the ways we can come to that conclusion is for every city that we looked at, Cleveland, Ferguson, Missouri, Baltimore, for every city that we looked at that came under the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice after every disturbance, after several of the shootings, et cetera, every last one of those cities was hit with a directive from the Department of Justice to clean up their policies, the various policies that govern their department were in disarray. So that just told us that, you know, something was going on in these departments. And then you have that sort of folklore of the thin blue line where police people stick together. And this comes up just this week with the officer in Minneapolis who shot that woman from Australia, and none of the fellow officers would come forward to testify. So we think we're on to something here.
Now, you mentioned objectivity, though, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful manner, but given your subject of your book, how do you avoid confirmation bias?
Oh, that's a good, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I think that's a great question. And, you know, I teach a methods course every semester, and so I'm constantly talking with my students about how you have to let the data reveal themselves and take it where it goes. And I think, you know, that's clearly what we had to do in this case. And this is part of, you know, part of the way that we try to make the argument is using numbers and using data. And for some people, you know, they can still put that wall up and the numbers aren't convincing. But, you know, as social scientists, that's clearly the tact that we're taking is amassing an empirical argument to be able to make a case.
Because, you know, speaking as a member of the law enforcement community and in preparation for this interview, this is very challenging for me. Because you're right. I'm going to concede that to you, Angela. You know, it is our natural inclination to throw up those walls. Oh my God, you know, they're attacking my profession. And I'm just an average Joe. I don't see race and crime. But that is such, and that is such a delicate area. I want to feel
wait,
that it's okay. go ahead, Earl.
You say you don't see race and crime, and that's part of what we address in the book when we get to our explanation of the theoretical apparatus that guides the research. And I'll let Professor Hattie speak to that in a moment, but race is in crime in so many specific ways, it's unbelievable. A guy named David Baldus, a legal scholar, did a major study, I don't know, 1986, that just hasn't been surpassed yet. And he showed the race of the victim determines the passing of the punishment. The race of the victim determines how the perpetrator is punished. Once you start looking at those kinds of data, once you look at the data on sentencing, once you look at the issue of powder cocaine and crack cocaine, how the sentencing is meted out, and once you look at the numbers of people who are actually incarcerated, all of that, and once you look at the demographics of all those police departments that we talk about in terms of Baltimore, Ferguson, Chicago, Cleveland, et cetera.
Sure.
All of that is heavily, heavily built around issues of race. Absolutely. If you walk into a jailhouse, you're going to see black prisoners. You go up into Wisconsin, where black people don't live, you're going to see black prisoners. So race is inside of the criminal justice system.
And you know what? Earl, I'm with you, because the last few years of my career in law enforcement, I am serving as a shift lieutenant in a correctional facility. Currently, I have 921 as of this morning. 921 inmates, 62% of which are black. But we're talking about initially, and I wanted to move on to this, you know, to our point as the criminal justice system as a second part of the interview. Initially, showing up as a deputy to a crime scene, I don't control the race of the perpetrator or the victim. I'm simply coming to a call. And unless I am misinterpreting, that is where you're concentrating a lot of your book material, is am I shooting a black unarmed citizen, or am I approaching a crime scene?
So here's my question, and this is fascinating. This is the dialogue we had hoped to start with the book, right? When we look at the data on, just taking as an example, the shooting of unarmed black men, there's not necessarily a crime taking place, right?
Well, we're responding to something.
Not with Stephon Clark. I mean, he was just in his backyard, from what we can tell. Not with Castile, who was simply getting the paperwork that the officer was asking for. A lot of these issues don't in fact entail a crime. But when you show up at the crime scene, you don't see black or white, you see a crime scene. But when these officers are interviewed, the first thing they tell the whoever they're talking to, the legal people, is I saw a big black man. So and I was afraid of him, and I thought he was going to kill me. So you go back to Mike Brown in Ferguson, who was shot, and on TV we could see his body laid in the street for about 5 hours. The officer who shot him said just that. He was just this big black guy, and oh my gosh, I feared for my life. Then when we look at the data, the officer is the same size as is Mike Brown. So we're not psychologists, but something is triggered in many of these offices. The woman in Oklahoma that killed the gentleman right by his car.
Terrence Kutcher.
What's his name?
Terrence Kutcher?
Yeah. These folks see something that doesn't exist in reality. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they talk about it in psychology, but this victim looks huge and big. But these people are not.
Oh, sorry. Has that comparison been made to white individuals as well? When have you studied the reaction of officers when they attend the scene and report a large white person stood there and they think they're going to be shot? Have you? I'm sure you have, but have you compared those kind of statistics and reactions of officers?
No, I don't remember ever reading that. An officer, white or black, whoever they are. And the other point we need to make is several of the shootings were by non-white officers. But
are we talking about reported? Are we talking about instances that have been reported in the press, or are we talking about a research study that has expanded past that point and is as interviewed or has had the accounts of officers as they've attended the scene of any crime, regardless of the colour? I mean, I'm certainly not falling on one side of this argument or the other. I'm just trying to think from a research perspective, has the same parameters been put on that research to white individuals involved in crime? So it's not just reporting.
Well, that's a good question.
In the press, it will be about reactions of individuals across the states to a crime observing in front of
Yeah, that's a great question. As what there are actually a number of quite a lot of studies. Most of them are done by psychologists. Who often it's an experiment where you're showing people images and asking them to react to those images. But I think one of the most interesting studies, and they all, you know, they all kind of come out in with similar findings. And there's a variety of different ways that they're done, but they're mostly done by psychologists. But another really interesting piece of research that we cite in the book was interviewing black and white citizens who have been pulled over by the police on a traffic stop. And what's really, really interesting about what that research showed was that we use the same term that the researchers use. They use the term legitimate traffic stop and a fishing expedition. And they argue that when the stop is legitimate, so someone has run a red light, is, you know, way over the speed limit, is done something that any of us would consider a traffic violation, black and white motorists experience the stop pretty much exactly the same way. There's no racial bias in terms of who's pulled over, and there's no racial bias experience in the stop itself. When black and white drivers are interviewed about what the researchers call fishing expeditions, so people are pulled over for something that's, you know, not some sort of clear crime or a clear serious traffic violation, like, you know, a tail light or a tag or something that's very insignificant, that's where racial bias shows up. And in those cases, and to use your term, where there's not a clear crime taking place, not only are blacks far more likely to be pulled over, but they're far more likely to experience it as a stop gone wrong. And so that research, and it with interviews with 1,000 citizens about their experiences with traffic stops, has been used by us and other people to help explain some of the cases that we've been talking about. Philando Castile in Minneapolis, Terrence Kutcher in Oklahoma, that those were stops that fall into the category of fishing expedition rather than sort of legitimate stops. So I would imagine, I mean, I'd love to hear the perspective of you know, of an officer. But I would imagine if you're only pulling people over who should be pulled over, you might not see racial bias because drivers don't see it either when it's legitimate. It's when they're illegitimate, kind of unfounded, like I'm looking for you because you're driving in a place I don't expect you to be or whatever. That's when you see the racial bias pop out.
And those studies, there's a lot of those studies like that. To answer back to the other question, when we talk about the size of the perpetrator, that data that we use comes right from these, what do you call them? These officers, who are telling their story as to why they pulled the trigger. So it's not just from USA Today or the New York Times.
Oh no, Earl, I wasn't implying that. I guess what I was saying, and it was answered, you know, fantastically by Angela. It was kind of that perception of a crime scene, and the moment that you have to react and make a decision, your perception, and then later how you relay what was going on at the time. Has studies been undertaken to look at the individual perceptions, whether that person in front of an officer is white, black, is their reaction the same, or is there an absolute research study that says if that person in front of you is black, you're more likely to depict them in a menacing way than if a white person was in?
Yes, 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 yes.
And those studies have been done with a variety of different types of samples, right? So they're community-based studies, they're college samples, they're kind of all over the map, and they keep getting replicated in the same way. And I think, you know, to Earl's point earlier, it's not just white people who perceive black people as perhaps bigger or scarier or someone they're less inclined to want to talk to. Many black participants in these studies also carry those same stereotypes, right? Uh-huh. So that helps us understand why some of the police shootings are police shootings by black officers, right? They've been trained in the same ways.
So, Angela, would it be fair to say... I'm sorry. Earl, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to give you a name of an officer, a black officer, in Gaston County, North Carolina, who gave an interview. He lives right outside of Charlotte. And from his perspective, he's an officer. He's an African-American officer. He's proud to be a police person. And in his interview, if the data is correct, he says there is a clear fear, F-E-A-R, of black men. I mean, this is an officer who works with other officers in a police department in North Carolina. He says from his time on the force, he's come to the conclusion that there's a fear, a huge fear of black men. And when I read this, I think about other kinds of studies that are done by communication scholars who show images around to the students in their classrooms. And we come away with this notion, or the studies about the elevators, when black men are on the elevator, whites get on the elevator, the kinds of body language that changes, and depending on what they're wearing, one day they're wearing a suit and a tie and carrying a briefcase, the next day they're wearing a jumpsuit and a hoodie. I mean, these studies are there, and they keep telling us the same thing over and over and over. I mean, right here on our campus, when you talk to students in class, black students and white students will say, I did this, and I wasn't pulled over. I was pulled over. I wasn't given a ticket. Black students said, I didn't do anything, but I got a ticket. I just think the way we handle it in the book, and we don't, I want to make this clear, we don't have a perspective as if we've come at it to say that we hate police. We make it very clear that's not our intent and that's not what we did. We're just taking a subject that I mean, so alive, trying to put the dots together on this subject. Let me mention one more thing. We have a chapter in the book that nobody talks about. Nobody. And it's about exoneration.
Yes.
And when you look at the data on exoneration, this helps clarify all the things that we've been talking about thus far. To be exonerated, you have to have been convicted of some crime that you didn't commit. And yet, the data that we have in this chapter shows that disproportionately, those men who are being exonerated using DNA evidence are black men. So you say, well, why are they being stopped, arrested, convicted, sentenced 30 years, 15 years, 20 years for crimes they didn't commit, and then, you know, 25 years down the road, somebody finds, oh, you didn't do it. You didn't do the crime. Sorry, we better let you out of prison. Why are these black men, predominant number of prisoners, being exonerated if there isn't some kind of bias, systemic bias, against who they are?
Mm.
That's deep.
It is. And
since you're law enforcement, you know, you want to get it right. The first thing you want to do is get it right. But in this case, it's as if the first thing you want to do is not be concerned with getting it right. Just lock somebody up. Let them sit in some gall for 30 years and then say, and prosecutors, we address the issue of prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
Prosecutors don't have anybody they have to be accountable to. Who are they accountable to?
Actually, they're accountable to the public. I'll disagree
okay.
with you there,
okay.
and we can agree to
okay.
disagree. And
okay,
that's okay.
Yeah, that's good.
But take a look at
that chapter on exoneration. It is deep. And then we have some chapters that address transgender people. Women. So, yeah. Angela, you
want to
say something about some of those chapters?
Well, sure. I'm not sure. We only have a few minutes left. If there's something else you wanted to get in on the conversation.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's
okay.
That's okay. Go ahead, Angela.
Well, I mean, we talk about, and again, this is moves it a little bit outside of just the criminal justice system, but we look at, you work in a prison. We looked at the way that women and trans inmates are housed. I'm not sure, do you work in a men's prison or a women's prison?
I work in a correctional facility, so we have everything that comes in. I am not a state, I'm a county. So we get everything.
Oh, you're a county. Okay.
Pre-trial, sentenced, we get it all.
Mm. You have the hard work then. That's especially hard. I don't know if you've housed trans inmates, but they present a really complicated problem.
That is an interesting question, and here's why. I don't mean to cut you off, but Dr. Smith, he brought it up, and I was sitting here thinking this is a unique situation that we're facing, and let me give it to you from my side. A transgender inmate, we have to house them according to what they identify as. However, we also have to protect them from predators within the facility. I mean, let's be intellectually honest. We have predators in our facility. And I see it as a personal responsibility to protect them from the predators and at the same time honor their request to be housed according to their affiliation, and that provides a very, very unique problem.
Yeah, it really does. I agree. And you know what we argue, what we talk about in the book is that unique challenge. And it seems like in both reading different cases, but also we did some interviews last summer in a state prison system, it seems like it's really variable, that some facilities really get it right, other facilities really don't. And so part of what we talk about in the book is how to come up with strategies that can do exactly what you said, without causing any undue stress to the inmate, because at least in most of the cases we've looked at, often the protection means solitary confinement. How can we come up with better systems?
You're right.
For housing people.
Because I don't want to do that to a person based simply on their affiliate. I really, as a corrections official, I don't want to place anybody in segregation if I don't have to.
And certainly not just because they have a particular identity, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So it creates tremendous challenges. And that's one of the issues we talk about in that chapter. You know, in the chapter on women, we also talk about the unique case that women present, in the sense of when they come in to a facility and they're pregnant and they're going to deliver that child during their period of incarceration. How can we come up with better strategies short of shackling them to the bed while they labor and deliver? Something that I think, you know, at least women would be able to understand is not the best treatment for the mother or the child. How can we come up with better strategies that protect public safety, protect the women, protect the child, you know, and instead of a lot of situations where we're not doing that.
You know, and speaking, I am so glad you said that. And listen, guys, I am speaking now officially as a corrections lieutenant. I welcome any advice that you would have on that, because we do face that. Working in a pretrial setting, we have actually had women in that very situation. As a young officer, I have attended births of women inmates.
Oh,
and it has been exactly as you stated. You know, we shackle them to the bed, and not by my, you know, not because I wanted to, and not based on their race or their sex, simply because that was policy. But I'm also a human being, and I see the humanity of these situations, and I don't want to shackle anybody to a bed, especially as they're giving birth. And then I've had to witness the agony of a mother being separated from her newborn child simply because that is the system. You know, we have to find
a family member
to take that child. And if no family member steps forward, guess where they go? Because this woman has got to go do her time. I don't want to see that. You know, I don't want to see that.
I appreciate your perspective. And that's part of what we talk about in the book. We interviewed women who had that experience. And you know, and again, it seems to vary tremendously by jurisdiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we interviewed women who weren't allowed to call the family member until they were back in the prison, which cut down on the amount of time the family member had to get there to get the child before the baby, before it went into foster care. That just seems like there's a better workaround than that, right? That we can protect public safety, we can deliver babies in a healthy way, we can, you know, provide the surrogate care for them, whether that's a family member or something else, in a way that is not so stressful, not so dehumanizing, and doesn't end up with so many kids in a foster care system where they're then set up, you know, far more likely to follow in the path of their, you know, of their parent, of their mom in this case. That's exactly the issues that we try to take on the book. How can we do it better?
Right. And again, encompassing all, because we're beginning to run short on time, to encompass this entire conversation. Oops, I didn't mean to bump the mic. I apologize. Again, you know, going back to racial or gender or transgender issues or all these issues, I've been in this business a little over 20 years, and I would suggest, and here's my suggestion, and I know there's no chapter in the book that encompasses this, because again, it's written from perspectives. And just being an average Joe that works in a jail now, if we would just simply get to know the inmates as people, not as races, not as gender, get to know them as people, which is what I spent a lot of my time doing. Know them as people, know them where they come from, and try to understand their unique socioeconomic backgrounds and get to know them as people, that would solve a lot of these problems. Let's bring it back to humanity, not race, not gender, or, you know, you're a bad guy or you're a good guy. As an officer wearing gray and wearing a badge, I am one mistake away from being them. And that is how I see it.
Wow. I think also, Kevin, it's this understanding that, you know, it's the way we treat people is the way that they treat other people, the way they treat their children, the way. So even if we're using that one example that you were helpfully giving, Angela, about women and giving birth in prisons, you know, in the UK, everything will be done to try and support that. In the prison system, and that is so vital given that what we know about child development and attachment and the cycles of parenting styles that we see time and time again. And it's no different what you were saying, Kevin, about that back down to humanity, how we treat people. Every single person is replicated by them. There's nothing more simple than that saying, is if we smile, somebody smiles back. It's just crazy to think, but yes. Segregate people, isn't it, in this way?
You know, over my 20 some odd years, I'm sorry, Angel, I don't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
Oh, no, just because I have to walk to class. So if I could just make one last comment and then can finish the conversation.
Sure.
I think Kevin, you're exactly right. And I think, you know, part of what we also talk about in the book is the uniqueness of the American criminal justice system. That we lock up way, way more people disproportionate to the rest of the world. We lock up way, way more people for nonviolent offenses, for drug offenses. And we, you know, we have conditions that are not replicated, certainly not in most other post-industrial economies. So I think taking an international view is another place we could think about how can we do this better.
Absolutely.
I only watched a documentary about 2 weeks ago about how in America, children who murder are given life sentences or can be given life sentences without parole. So a child of 10 or 12 who has committed murder, they may get the chance in their 20s to appeal, but once that appeal is done and dusted, that's it. They're there for life. Mm-hmm. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, but that's the system.
Terrible. That's 100% right. I'm going to let you all finish the conversation. Thank you very much, you guys.
Angela, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Earl, I'd like to give you the last word today.
Bye-bye.
Well, I'd like to follow up on the last point. There's a gentleman who's now 71 or 72 years old. His name is Henry Montgomery. His case went before the Supreme Court about 2 weeks ago. And he was one of those 15 or 16-year-olds who got life without the possibility of parole.
Wow.
When we talked about it, we said, well, you know what? Charlie Manson, who just died, Charlie Manson had a sentence where he could receive parole.
Hmm.
And yet Henry Montgomery sits there since the time he's, you know, 14 or 15. Now he's 72. And he can never get out of prison. And when the Supreme Court took the case, they threw it back to another court, lower court, which said, well, he has to meet parole. And I think, I'm not clear on this, but I think when he went back to try and get released from prison, they said he hadn't done certain kinds of things. And I'm thinking, he's been in there 50-plus years.
That's crazy.
Yeah, what does it take?
Exactly. So I think that the issues you brought up about becoming a more human criminal justice system.
Yes.
Put policemen, and I know it's expensive, put policemen back in communities where they meet the people in the community, they talk to them, they have they used to call police community relations boards. I had police in my community. They would come around and talk to you. They might come into your house if it's cold or wet or snowing and have a cup of coffee or a bowl of soup. And I'm serious about this. And today, every policeman that I know about, they ride around in cars, they got big shotguns sticking up between the seats. Their apparatus is military apparatus. I mean, this is scary. And I think we need to just scale back and try to get these folks talking to each other. Police, community members, young men, young girls, so that they're not afraid of the police and the police are not afraid of them.
Well, Earl, I'll do you one better. And this is speaking as a member of law enforcement. Again, I have looked down the sight of a weapon and have found it hard to shoot anybody of any race, of any gender. And my suggestion is this, and I'm speaking to all law enforcement officials. I think that a police officer, before they hit the streets, need to do at least 2 years in the jail. Why? Because it's hard to walk away or drive away. You're in there with these people as people. And you're forced into a situation to where you either get along or you fail. Because you can't drive away, you can't drop them off at a jail and walk away. You've got to be with them. And we work 12-hour shifts. You've got to deal with them on a human level. And that would be my suggestion. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, no. I worked in a maximum security prison myself a long time ago. And we did these interviews this summer in a state in solitary confinement. And one prison on death row.
Earl, I'm going to need you to hit Johanna because interview.
Okay,
I got to go.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, Earl, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Earl.
All right.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too, sir.
Angie, bye-bye.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
Hello, welcome back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary, and I am Stephen David Lampley. Welcome. Did you know that all, and I said all, of the world's digital information that is currently available in all forms could be stored on just 2 grams of human DNA. Today we're going to talk about DNA, and I'm going to try to make it interesting because I'll be honest, to me DNA is a pretty boring subject. It does have some amazing applications in crime and forensics. This is the first part of a series on DNA. Alright, so stay with me on this. Some of you are probably thinking DNA, yawn, yawn, yawn. I'm going to listen to something else and I'll come back after the DNA segment's over. I get that, okay? I'm going to try to make it interesting, and I'm trying to give you some facts and some trivia about DNA that's going to make it more interesting. DNA is really a good crime-solving tool. All right, what is DNA? DNA, the name for DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid. Okay, there'll be a test after this, so make sure you take notes. I'm just kidding. All right, DNA is a thread-like, ladder-looking chain that's responsible for carrying the genetic instructions for a variety of functions, such as basic functioning, the development, growth, and reproduction of organisms, and even some viruses. DNA is a powerful, powerful tool. Simply put, though, DNA is the hereditary material in organisms. Did you know that humans share 50% of their DNA with bananas. All right, so next time you're in the store, walk over to the banana section, wave, and say, "Hey, cuz, do humans share 50% of their DNA with bananas?" Try finding them on your family tree, okay? Okay, now this thread-like material that is found in each cell, okay, now the DNA that's found in each cell, if it was straightened out and laid end to end, it would measure approximately, listen carefully, it would measure approximately 10 billion miles. Go look it up if you don't believe me, okay? 10 billion miles. That's enough to go to Pluto and come back home again. Each DNA strand is approximately 1.8 meters long, and it's compacted into a space, folks, that's 9/100ths of a micrometer. We're talking some really amazing facts here. DNA is located in the part of the cell called the nucleus, and the nucleus is basically the brain of the cell. Now, this packaged form of DNA is often referred to as a chromosome. All right, now let's talk about genome for a moment, and then we're going to end up, and we'll come back next time and continue on with DNA. Genome. What in the crap is a genome? A genome is a person's total genetic material. It's everything that is involved in genetics. That's a person's genome. Right? A person's genome is so expansive that it would take a person 50 years working 8 hours a day, typing 60 words a minute, to type out the entire human genome. So when we talk about DNA, we're talking about something that's miraculous. All right, our time is up today. We will come back next time and continue our discussion on DNA, and I'm going to try to give you some more information. We're going to, after we get through basically telling you what DNA is, so that when we get on to the forensics part, you'll understand it. We're going to talk about the forensics parts of that as far as crime and court. So it's been a pleasure being with you again. I look forward to having you back next time.
Thank you for tuning in to Stephen's True Crime Commentary, and we welcome you to check out Stephen's book, Outside Your Door, a collection of true crime stories right from Stephen's case file and street experience. You want true crime? Let Stephen take you to the streets with him. It doesn't get much more real than from the officer and undercover SVU detective himself. 5-star rated with Amazon, Barnes, and Noble, and books a million. Real cases. Real stories. Real people. Outside Your Door, by Stephen David Lampley.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.